This is Greg Hughes on the right.
This is not Jim DeBacchus on the left.
And this is Natalie Gochner. And you're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle, a lively and informative conversation about politics and current issues facing the state of Utah. Today, we will talk about Medicaid expansion and the ongoing debate about how we address that problem. New state revenue forecasts. What does it mean for our state? And the LGBT town hall hosted last night. But first, this news.
I'm Jim DeBacchus on the left.
And I'm Greg Hughes on the right.
And I'm Natalie Gochner, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle, a lively and informative conversation about politics and current issues in Utah. We've got a full show today, and we want to welcome Representative Greg Hughes back to the show. Member of Republican leadership has finally found time for Both Sides of the Aisle. Greg, welcome back.
It's 3 a.m., Natalie, but I'm happy to be here. No, it's not. I've lost all sense of time.
Well, we love having you on the show. I think we have about 13 days or so left in the session. Give us the vantage of, you know, where we're at from your point of view.
Well, have you ever seen April 15th on tax day when everybody's lined up paying their taxes, waiting to the last second? That is human nature at its best. Well, the legislature practices kind of the same thing in that it always starts kind of slow, kind of groggy. Things are starting to step up, but we won't really get to the meat of it until the last couple days. That's when all the big, big stuff gets decided. And so 45 days of constitutional authority the legislature has, and we probably exercise 80% of it in those last two
right
or three days.
And today's a big day. New revenue numbers. I'm expecting to see them. I don't know. Have they come out yet? What are we going to see?
Any second now. You should be hearing in the news breaking news about revenue numbers. These are forecasts that the fiscal analysts look at a year and a half ahead of time, because we have to balance our budget, and we have to balance it on some number. They have been amazingly accurate through the hardest of times during recession to the best of times during economic booms. Our fiscal analysts, nonpartisan, have always given us numbers that have almost been, I mean, within $70 million of a $13 billion budget. They've been very good, so those numbers mean something.
Jim, I'm guessing over there in Senate land and over on the left, you've got the inside scoop on revenue numbers. What are you thinking?
You'd be dead wrong.
You think numbers mean anything,
Jim? I get nothing over there.
You do realize how important they are.
Yeah, and, you know, I have a basic fundamental flaw with the way that Utah does this budgeting process.
I'll bet it's disastrous.
If you have a business and you set up a five-year plan, frankly, I don't know a lot of businesses that have a five-year plan. We're all trying to, you know, skirt along. But let's suppose you had a five-year plan. You need to be visionary. You need to say, this is what we're going to spend. Here's our commitment. Here's where we have to go. Or if you've got a family, you say, okay, our plan is we're going to feed the kids. We're going to feed them no matter what. It doesn't matter what the revenue is. We're going to feed our kids. The legislature says, you know, maybe we'll feed the kids. Maybe we won't feed the kids. Let's just see what comes in. And some years we'll give them steak. And some years there isn't even enough for peanut butter and jelly sandwiches.
Greg is dying. He's almost out of his seat.
Listening to Jim talk is like shooting fish in a barrel, Natalie. Ladies and gentlemen, what you just heard is a person who said, ignore the numbers. There are no numbers. It's just what you'd like taxpayers to pay. You'd like what the revenues bring in because you want to be aspirational in all things, do all things for all. That's what Congress does. They don't even pay attention to balancing a budget. We have to. We don't have a choice but to balance a budget so those numbers actually mean something.
Well, and
we have to do it.
The financial crisis that we just went through was all about, you know, living beyond our means, not having fiscal conservatism. We overspent and we paid a price.
Jim would have you just spend and spend until...
Which financial crisis did we have that was caused by that? What the financial crisis we had was caused by the big one, caused by profligate bankers going crazy and lending out
stupid loans. It was household debt getting to levels
that liar loans.
That wasn't Congress's fault.
Look, it was liar loans. It was people spending money they didn't have.
Well, we all agree on that.
Well, so coming back to the legislative session, you know, the economy's good right now. I'm expecting revenue numbers to be a little higher than they were at the start of the session. I think we'll have more money to spend.
Well, when we say more, it's always relative because...
He's going to qualify here,
Jim. I'm going to tell you right now, we are a very healthy state comparing us to other states in this country. However, these are not... this is not a recovery that you've seen in past years or past cycles. This has been a very slow uptick. And because of that, tucking away money for the rainy day fund, preparing for the next downturn in the economy, which we do every time you see numbers increase, it's been a lot harder to really education, population growth, and of our students that come into our schools more every single year. Medicaid, the growth without expanding the growth in terms of the budget. There are a lot of just maintenance costs of our state government that this economy is barely keeping pace with.
Jim, that did not sound very aspirational. I know that two of you have a problem with that word.
Here's the vision issue. We have 14,300 new kids coming in September to our schools. They're coming. It's too late to say, we can't really afford you. So the question is, and what the legislature says is, you know what? If there's money, then we educate them. If there's no money, we just shove them into the schools. And we don't give them any more money, and that happened in 2009 and 2010. We actually gave them less money. My point is, when you have children, it's too late to decide, revenue projections are all bad, we can't actually feed them. No, they're our responsibility. So that means you better be innovative, you better be creative, you better dip into these rainy day funds or severance tax, hideaway
funds. And you better raise taxes.
And if necessary, absolutely,
Natalie,
they're your kids.
Within that description, what Jim did not mention is the over a half a billion dollars in rainy day funds that we were able to put into public education to make it even to at least mitigate some of the shortfalls that were coming. So for Jim to say, look at what we didn't do in those years, it could have been so much worse if we were not prepared for that downturn like we were.
I just have to, I give the legislature huge kudos for their fiscal fitness. They have a AAA bond rating. They have money set aside in a rainy day fund. They have a balanced budget. Our governor has a line item veto. It doesn't get any better than that, Jim.
It gets a lot better than that. Look at Massachusetts. Massachusetts children compete on an international level. They're in the top five when it comes to scores, when it comes to graduation rates, when it comes to a lot of other things. We need that same kind of commitment. And if it means raising taxes, guess what?
He pulled the Massachusetts card, Greg.
Let me just tell you this. Instead of going to the taxpayer and asking for more, because that is actually part of the economy and job growth, and we need to see a regulatory climate and a tax burden that isn't prohibitive, do this with me, Jim. Massachusetts gets to actually see property tax for its schools from its whole state. Imagine if 65% of this state actually derived a property tax or a severance tax. Join me in taking that land that the federal government's still hedging its bet, has not turned over to the state of Utah. Let's go get that land, make it Utah land. Let's manage it appropriately. Let's see the revenue for it, and let's fund schools four times what we're doing today.
I'm opposed to taxing the church. That's all I can say.
Public lands always seems to come up in this program. Real quickly, we do have a sales tax issue on the agenda that deals with giving more local option to raise the sales tax for transit. Greg, you are the chair of the UTA board.
Yep.
I'm guessing you like that bill. Real quickly, what do you see there?
So one important distinction to make is that the Utah legislature does not fund UTA. This is a local option, a local authority funded enterprise.
And so, this means cities, counties.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's a sales tax. That is a revenue. So there's a bill by Representative Johnny Anderson that would allow local option, counties, to be able to raise incrementally, and not a lot, the sales tax to increase routes, to increase service, to try and bring back some of the service that we had that we lost during the deep recession. That recession impacted sales tax. And that sales tax, again, UTA has to pay the bills as well. It impacted routes. Those routes would increase. More ridership would absolutely result in cleaner air.
Jim, I'm guessing we have agreement on this bill, a good thing.
I have a question for the distinguished representative.
Uh-oh.
So is it true that the fare box only brings in less than $3 million a month?
Well, it's $46 million a year. I'd have to do the math, and my head's fried. I can't, but whatever that is.
I mean, it's $3.5 million total. And some people that I know are getting passes from Provo, and it's costing them close to $200 if you add in the train and all the connections. Why can't we come up with that extra $3.5 million and drastically reduce the cost of public transit and get them packed, clean our air, just have a system that would be stunningly improved?
Jim, you've raised a good question. We'll talk about it in our next segment, along with Medicaid expansion. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Natalie Gochner. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm joined on the left by Jim DeBacchus. Jim, welcome.
Thank you.
And on the right by Greg Hughes.
Good morning, Natalie.
Great to have distinguished representatives on the show. I'm just someone who sits up in the stands and watches you guys, but you're
right.
Doing a great job.
Yeah, we're believing that.
That is not true. Yeah. There's levers up there, Jim. Woo! We know she's pulling those levers. We know it.
More money for transit. Jim, we closed out the last session by you, I think, making the pitch to have more money for transit. And you like that in a whole variety of ways. Complete your thought, and we'll let Greg give his comments.
Look, a third of the money that we spend on transportation in the state, only a third of it comes from users. Our sales tax on, or the tax that goes for fuel tax, 24.5 cents, has been locked in there for a generation. It's ridiculous. We're robbing money from our school children now, because that's where the general fund primarily goes, and we're fluffing it out there to keep transportation going. It ought to be a user tax. That gas tax needs to go up. We need to reflect the cost of transportation with the people that use it.
Well, look, there's a $46 million and climbing revenue from farebox recovery. You got to find a replacement for it. Jim proposes that it be from fuel tax. It's a little more complicated because fuel tax has to go for our roads, but it would offset some of the other taxes that are received
that you could
use and commit to transit. But you know what? That would be asking this legislature in many ways to be raising a tax of $46+ million a year, and there's not a lot of appetite for that with the legislature.
Tell me on Anderson's bill, recognizing that it is a local option, it does not raise taxes, it just allows local government to do that should they choose to, and a vote of the people and all that. What would UTA do with that money? What would be the benefit to the user?
And that was what the sponsor of the bill asked before he ever filed the bill. What could you get? What are the possibilities here under a scenario like that? And it is increased routes. It is better service. It is, especially in the times where we see these inversion months, and we know when they are, it is being able to utilize and make sure that this infrastructure through mass transit has more and more access. That is something that has always been hard.
Could it mean streetcar to the university from downtown?
It wouldn't be a capital development. We didn't want
this.
This is clean air. This is how do you get more riders on the infrastructure we have today, and that is what it's committed to.
Frequency.
Yes, it's not a future project idea. It is a get people on mass transit so they're out of their cars. 60% of the pollution we see are tailpipes. So.
Yeah, great. Jim, I want to turn to you for just a minute. Last night was a memorable, honorable night for our state. We had a town hall meeting with state leaders and the gay community. Neither Greg or I were there. You were there. You helped organize this. Can you just give us a sense for what happened, what happened at this important meeting?
There were a number of legislators who told me and said publicly that they had been in the legislature for many years and they had never experienced anything like happened last night. With the divisiveness, with the bitterness, with the embarrassment of what happened in Arizona, I think last night Utah had a very proud moment where it showed that Utah is almost uniquely able to come together as a community to face social issues, to face awkward moments. I saw 40 legislators, according to the Trib. People came and went, as it's very busy. Half of them Republicans, half of them Democrats, the lieutenant governor, other statewide officers. I saw men and women that came in, I think, questioning.
Probably scared.
With a bit of a chip on their shoulder, a little bit. And I saw that kind of positioning in the chair that legislators have. No doubt I have it occasionally with witnesses where you're skeptical or give me your best shot. And I watched as 12 witnesses went up and told their experience about living in Utah as an LGBT person. I saw transgendered people come up and tell their stories. And I saw the eyes of the legislators open up, who many of whom, my guess is, had never really met a transgendered person. It was almost a spiritual experience. So you saw physically, I saw legislators kind of go from that rigidness sitting in their chair to more relaxed, to understanding, to watching, then to put their heads in their hands and get emotional.
Mm-hmm.
These are tough, mean legislators
mean.
Who for the first time
had a tender moment.
I think had a connection. Now, where that leads, whatever happens, there was a wonderful moment, and I think everybody else, and there were 300 or 400 people, and it was piped into other rooms because there were so many people there. But it happened on the other side, too. For the first time, a lot of people from all over the state, from the LGBT community, were able to look up and see people that they thought were listening and that they thought represented them. Mm-hmm. I saw President Niederhauser say some incredible things, something that almost never happens in the political world. The lieutenant governor came, and the procedure was these 12 people told their stories, and if you can get these stories, you should listen. They're 3 or 4 minutes each. They are moving beyond words. They're all Utahns speaking in the first person. So then everybody went around the horseshoe, all the legislators, and gave their feelings, which were really, really interesting. So the lieutenant governor had to go downtown to speak. So he he spoke before the presentations were done and said some very warm things, went down and gave his speech downtown. And then something I've never seen before, he came back.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, politicians escape from a meeting
They're
gone. He came back and he stood in the back, he listened, and then he spent another hour meeting the various witnesses, one of whom was from a transgender from St. Pete County. It was a remarkable moment, I think, in our long legislative history, and I was proud to be involved, and I was so proud to be a legislator. And I said, and I know my friend here is kicking to get in, but I said at the end, "You're my family," to all the LGBT people that were there. And now I have a new family, and they're on this side of the podium. And in whatever you, my old family, may think, my new family has been warm, supporting, generous, and completely open with myself and Stephen in every situation at the legislature. And I thank them, and that's absolutely true. And when they do bad things to me and when they say bad things, it's not because I'm gay.
Mm-hmm.
But they
a
do
lot of progress, Greg.
Well, that was going to be my question. Is that I would hope I wanted to be at this meeting desperately. I had a town hall meeting we had scheduled, and so I wasn't able to be there. But I would hope that the empathy and the understanding would be mm-hmm. both ways. I hope that some that thought that the legislature was coming from a place of hatred or mm-hmm. a place of bigotry saw lawmakers grappling with issues that they're not familiar with, or sharing their conviction for religious freedoms or why they make the decisions they do, and that we wouldn't see animus, that we wouldn't see hatred, and maybe there's a better understanding of the legislature or members of the legislature and what motivates them. And it isn't hope. I mean, not from my experience has it been a place of hatred. It's been concern on a bunch of different fronts. But I think that that's an educational experience that all of us need to have.
Beautiful thing. And the meter of understanding went up really high. And just from the political middle, I would just thank Jim for his leadership there. I thank Senator Urquhart, President Niederhauser. And it sounds like our Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox really did a wonderful job. So great things. Still on a real serious topic, Medicaid expansion.
Yes.
This is a big issue right now because you have a Representative Dunnigan in the House who's carrying, you know, sort of, I guess, the Speaker's bill on Medicaid expansion. You have my Senator, Brian Shiozawa, in the Senate, has a more middle ground proposal. And then we have Governor Herbert, who tells us he's got a proposal that we're going to see here real soon, but I don't know exactly what that is. Greg?
Word on the street, Natalie, is that the governor and Senator Shiozawa may come together on his proposal. I will tell you this. I think the House proposal is one that says, look, we need to identify this group, this population in Utah that has been left out of the conversation. It's really not an expansion. There's a donut hole.
Mm-hmm.
It's within the middle. These are people without children but are within the limits or the definitions of poverty. We are trying to narrow that down and make sure that there is critical care available there, but we're trying to do it without the Medicaid deal because we're worried about the sustainability of Medicaid funds that with the federal government and the way they've been funding or the way they change the rules.
You just don't like free money.
it's just not. If it's too good to be true, it probably is. And I'm going to tell you, 90% of the Medicaid expense being paid by the federal government, it sounds great, and I'm sure there's a lot of flies on that flypaper, but I do not believe that that is a sustainable funding formula and that this state would be stuck with and having to grapple with immense costs. We already see Medicaid as it is right now eating up more and more of our state budget. I cannot imagine how we take that deal. But that said, The House has a plan with state dollars to try and do right by the most needy of this segment we're talking about.
I think it underhits the mark. Just a personal opinion, Jim. Where are you at on that?
So the Dunnigan,
this is the House plan. I'm
guessing. The Dunnigan plan is imbecilic.
Is that synonymous with
imbecile?
Awesome?
The governor called it illogical.
I'm saying it's an imbecile. And I'm not causing any, making this personal, but this is the worst plan ever created. It does nothing good. It costs the taxpayers $35 million, and it does a lot less. Then you've got the Shiazawa bill, which is just dumb. So you've got completely over the edge that it isn't even deserved discussion, the House bill. Then you've got Brian Shiazawa, who's a good guy. This is a very bad bill. Staring Utahns right in the face is a solution. We're paying taxes to Washington. This year, $434 million.
This would be our income taxes.
It's going in a big bucket that says Utah on it. And they've got a check or a FedEx. Then they're going to send this barrel back to us to help over 123,000 Utahns get medical coverage. And the ideologues, my dear friend may not be included, the ideologues are saying, whoa, wait a minute. Even though it's our money, we don't want that federal money. It's tainted. It's dirty. We paid that. We're not taking it. And on behalf of our elitist philosophical view, we are going to teach you a lesson, Washington, and we're going to sacrifice 123,000 Utahns' medical coverage. If you're going to send this message, send it on the other $4 billion of federal dough.
Greg, he's being colorful.
Natalie, I need a flare gun on this program so I can at least get some attention over here. Listen, Jim. It's not that we think that that money is bad money or dirty money. We just don't believe that money's real. Okay, they're going to give it to you this year, maybe next year. It's not sustainable, my friend. It just is not. Let me tell you, it's like the Verizon commercial with the kids around the table. What's better, less or more? And every child says more, okay? Everybody's looking at this going more. You know in this appropriation process that when we see proposals for funding, there are many, many ways to improve the human condition. Let me ask you this. Instead of worrying about the more of this Medicaid, what I would call false promise, why don't we talk about the more or doing right by families with autism? Let's talk about something real. I will tell you, 1 in 47 of boys in Utah are being born with autism. It is a higher frequency than anywhere in this country. That's where the political capital ought to be spent. Not
Greg,
this 138% of poverty.
The political middle would say, do both. Take care of autism, take care of low-income Utahns without health insurance.
We only have so many dollars. That's the problem with our process. We have to weigh
Jim's
these
gonna
things.
Jim's going to say, we do have the dollars. Please, Jim.
No, you got an IOU.
No, this is specifically collected for Medicaid expansion as a surcharge. We're paying that. And to not take it for 3 years where it's 100%. You know, I hear from some of my good representatives again and again and again, not you, Greg, the federal government is going to collapse. It's going to be all over. We got to build bunkers. We need federalist reports to say what we're going to do when the federal government ends. We can't take this money. Well, it's very interesting to me. This is 100% money to take care of. But when it comes to their little water projects, when it comes to their road and transportation, when it comes to everything that is good for them or their little business development kind of things, the federal gravy train rolls in. But when it comes to poor people,
honestly,
no way.
There is a little bit of they just don't like the Affordable Care Act and they don't want to tie in.
Look. You're comparing two things. You're talking grants, which are one-time money, with this ongoing program that goes for generations potentially. That is so different. We're not talking the grants for infrastructure, roads, or water. We're talking, which is one time. We're talking about a system that we're going to have to live with and Utahns would have to live with for generations. We are worried about the sustainability of that. And I think the United States of America has been downgraded in its credit worthiness. The state of Utah has a AAA bond rating. Why would you, as a AAA bond rated state, depend on the AA bond rating or the AAA minus, whatever the rating is? It's less than our own state. We can't trust that. I mean, come on. It's a very risky venture, minimally.
No surprise to the listeners. We just have incredible disagreement on Medicaid expansion. It's time for our weekly gripes. I get to start out with a very quick one. I was at the Jazz game last night. I was very disappointed to see Ty Corbin pull Gordon Hayward with 7 minutes left in the fourth quarter. He was one assist away from a triple-double. This guy needed that in his young career. What was Corbin thinking? Jim, your gripe.
Mine has to do with the cheapskates in the legislature. We have
he's going to continue this argument.
234 museums in this state. Do you know how much money those 234 museums get?
A lot.
A direct appropriation, less than $250,000. This is the shame of the state. That ought to be 10 times, and
tradition.
It ought to be immediately. It is a shame.
Very quickly, Greg.
My gripe is this. This is a risky one for me. There is a group of conservatives that are at the Capitol right now complaining and criticizing technology in schools. They're complaining about computer adaptive testing, which was able to measure a child's proficiency more accurately, give real-time data. Technology is not evil. I am disappointed that anyone would confuse conservatism with anti-technology and the progress that we need in our schools. It's disappointing.
You've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. The program is produced by Elizabeth Dee and Tyler Ford. Thanks for listening.